The topic for today is Jesus and the future of humanity. We've chosen that because that's overwhelmingly what people asked for when we had our film evening a few weeks back. And also, as it happens, that topic dovetails with Professor Lennox's book, 2084. And that's what we'll focus on primarily today. We'll think about how developments in artificial intelligence and technology dovetail with the hope that's offered through Jesus Christ. As I mentioned before, to those of you on early, we'll be able to hear Professor Lennox's interview from Tuesday. That will hopefully go up on our website in the next day or so. I definitely encourage you to listen to that as well, and we'll try and build on that with the questions today. So one of the things that Professor Lennox does in his book, 2084, is to show us how the issues and questions raised by developments in artificial intelligence are actually issues that the Bible engages with. So lots of us on the call may be surprised by that and assume such an ancient book has nothing to say about real-world developments and the incredible scientific progress that we're seeing at the moment. So I'm going to ask John to give us a summary of two or three of the big issues that AI, artificial intelligence, throws up, and then ask him to show us how the Bible addresses and interacts with those issues. So we'll think about positives in AI, some of the dangers and how the Bible helps us engage with those, how developments in AI show a desire in us to improve ourselves, and then also look at how AI is, some people are hoping, will deal even with the problem of death. And then there'll be a chance, hopefully, for questions from the audience. As you say in your book, billions and billions of dollars are being thrown at artificial intelligence. Just tell us, from your view, what are some of the most exciting developments in artificial intelligence?
Well, thank you, and welcome to everybody who's watching and listening to this. I think it's helpful when we're thinking about artificial intelligence to realize that it splits into two parts. There's what's called narrow artificial intelligence, and that's the kind of AI that's actually working at the moment. We can illustrate that easily. It consists of a powerful computer, a database, and an algorithm for recognizing patterns in the database. For instance, in connection with, say, lung disease and COVID, you might take a million x-rays of lungs and get the best doctors in the world to label them with their diseases. And then you have trouble, and your x-ray is compared by the AI system, and it spits out a diagnosis, which on average will be better than you would get from your local hospital. And that kind of diagnostic technique using pattern recognition technology has been most impressive and very successful. And it's being used currently to develop vaccines for COVID-19. So that's an immensely positive use. But then we rapidly come into ethical problems, because the very same technology, pattern recognition, when you think about facial recognition technology, you can see that it's useful for a police force to be able to recognize a terrorist in a crowd. And that can be very useful. But also, we're aware that in certain parts of the world, there is a suppression of minorities by using facial recognition technology and artificial intelligence to keep very close tabs on them and to discriminate against them and to seriously invade their privacy. And I often say that narrow AI is like a knife, a very sharp knife. It can be used for surgery or it can be used for murder. And so there are immense ethical issues that come to play. And so, of course, that's immediately where, for Christians, the Bible is utterly relevant, because for the Christian, the base of morality lies in the character of God and what God has revealed about what is good and what isn't good. Now, the second kind of AI is the much more speculative kind, artificial general intelligence. That is the research that's going on to do one of two main things. Firstly, either to enhance existing human intelligence by bioengineering, by cyborg technology, and so on, to create a super intelligence, or to do that from scratch, building on some non-biological material like silicon. And that leads to a huge amount of hype. It's the province of sci-fi writers and the idea of uploading our brains in a permanent form and all this kind of thing. Now, before we write it all off as speculative, and a great deal is, we're nowhere near there yet, we need to realize that many serious scientists and thinkers in the world are preparing people's minds for some kind of change in humanity that would be engineered by scientists. Now, that raises a much deeper problem as to what is a human being. And here, the biblical material is extremely important, because one of the central statements around which all, to my mind, circles is the statement at the end of Genesis 1, that God made human beings, male and female, in his own image. Not long ago, I watched a very interesting lecture by Jordan Peterson on Genesis. And when he came to this statement, he said, look, this is the cornerstone of civilization, and we neglect it to our peril. And I think that's exactly right. So when we're thinking of artificial general intelligence, the quest for superintelligence, we need to bear in mind that we're going to have to think very seriously about what our view is of human beings, because much, but not all, of the work in that direction is being driven by an atheist agenda. And that makes a huge difference to your concept of what a human being is. My final initial point is artificial intelligence is just that, it's artificial. And a wonderful elderly pioneer in the field who wrote a paper with the title, "The Artificial in Artificial Intelligence is Real." In other words, the machine, for example, and the algorithms that examine x-rays, they are not intelligent. But what they do is they do something that normally requires human intelligence. They simulate intelligence. And that's what we mean by artificial intelligence. And there arises a great discussion as to whether it can be thought of as independent of consciousness, because, of course, narrow AI systems are not conscious. But those are questions for further down the line.
Thanks, John. That's so helpful, giving us such a good overview there. Can I just row back a little bit? And what if someone was to say, well, AI shows the incredible ingenuity and progress made by humanity, and surely that makes the Bible seem outdated and irrelevant. Why should I even look to the Bible to help me navigate this issue and deal with these ethical questions that you're talking about?
Well, I find that rather ironic, because it's in the Bible that we find the source of all this creativity and intelligence. And if we reject the existence of God, I would want to argue very strongly, as I've done in several of my books, that we don't have a credible source for the intelligence that we human beings have. Now, what the Bible does is place humanity in a unique position. I mentioned before this key statement that we're made in the image of God. And we need to realize what that's saying. You see, the universe, we are told in the Bible, shows God's glory, but it wasn't made in his image. Only human beings were. And this gives us a unique value and dignity that you find nowhere else. So let's start by saying the Bible is extremely positive about the value and dignity of human beings. The second thing is that if you turn over the first page of the Bible and come to the second one, it talks about God's command to the first humans to name the animals. Now, that's the beginning of biology. It's taxonomy. And indeed, taxonomy is the fundamental discipline, naming things. We do it in every branch of science, including AI. So God is pro-science in a sense that that lays down for me a mandate to actually do science. And of course, if we step back from that, it is the fact agreed by most historians that it was the Judeo-Christian worldview that's responsible for the rise of modern science. So instead of seeing a wedge between God, so to speak, and human creativity and science, the two fit together beautifully, which is why, of course, Newton, Kepler, Clark Maxwell, and Galileo and many others were believers in God, and that justified their scientific endeavor. So I feel very much at one with them, not my ability, but my conviction that having God in the picture makes sense of everything. And, you know, that's one of the things that has really figured largely in my Christian conviction. In science, we talk about the explanatory power of a theory. And when it comes to biblical worldview, the explanatory power of thinking of humans as made in the image of God, and therefore having not only creative abilities, but moral responsibility for how they use them, that puts us into a very big narrative or meta-narrative, as people call it these days. And it makes sense to me, which is one of the reasons why I am a Christian.
Thanks, John. That's so helpful. Going back to AI specifically, you mentioned some of the dangers of AI, the ethical issues, governments overreaching themselves. How does the Bible caution us against putting our ultimate hope in technological improvements and AI particularly?
Well, of course, if we search through the Bible in both the Old and New Testaments, we find that it talks a great deal about the way in which society ought to behave to function properly. And, for example, the prophets, they spoke very strongly about the exploitation of the poor and the misuse of funds and not treating workers properly. And we can translate that immediately into some of the problems with AI. Let me give you the obvious one. Sitting on my desk here is a very subtle machine that uses AI. It's called a smartphone. And here we are, billions of us, carrying around one of these, voluntarily allowing it to track us all over the place. But not only that, if we buy books, say, on Amazon, we'll have a pop-up in a few days' time, people who bought that book buy this book. What many people do not realize is the level of what is now called surveillance capitalism. That is the harvesting of information. And we have not agreed to it. We've never granted permission officially to it. That is being sold on in great quantities to third parties and being used to make millions, if not billions. And that raises very, very big ethical questions. How do you police that kind of thing? And going back to what I say to younger Christians, I say, look, if you're scientifically minded, this is actually a field you could get into. There's so much positive that can be done, particularly in medicine, but not only there. And by being in on the inside, you can then start thinking Christianly about the ethical problems that are raised and contribute effectively to the discussion, because we desperately need people that can actually do that kind of thing. So the moral precepts of the Bible, you just have to go through them to see and compare them, for example, with some of the principles now being laid down by some very senior people in connection with artificial general intelligence, because, of course, the fear is that if we create a super intelligence, it may not be benevolent. And how do you ensure that it will be benevolent? And people are really concerned about that. I think it was Elon Musk said, or Stephen Hawking, that in creating this kind of thing, we're summoning the demon. Now, I repeat, we're very far from doing that. I'm always amused when people are asked, when will it happen? It's always about 30 years' time, but it's been 30 years for a very long time. So the biblical relevance is extremely strong, because to be in a field like this demands character. And character can only be built by knowing the laws of God and by living them. Now, I would want to add in there that we need to be careful here. The Bible is not just a religious text in terms of telling us how we live. It tells us what's wrong with us in the first place that needs to be dealt with before we can have the power to live. And of course, again, this is something we see in AGI, the quest to turn humans into gods, which is perfectly explicit. Now, I don't know whether you want me to talk about that now, or you can lead the discussion a bit further down the line, because that has implications for human nature and our relationship with God and its basis.
I think it'd be great to hear a little bit about that, John. Why do you say that we want to become gods? What's wrong with wanting to improve ourselves, to upgrade ourselves, to become transhuman? Why is that dangerous? What's wrong with that?
Well, let's step back from that. One of the authors I interact with in my book 2084 is Yuval Noah Harari, who is an Israeli historian and is convinced of the AGI. He's a very interesting writer, but he has two agenda items for the 21st century. One is he regards physical death as simply a technical problem that will be solved by engineering and medicine. But he says then the second agenda item for the 21st century is to enhance human happiness by bioengineering, by drugs, by all kinds of cyborg implants and all this kind of thing, with the objective of achieving the transhumanist dream. He points out that we have, in his view, we have come from animals. And now that we've got high intelligence, we can take the whole human development into our own hands and, to quote him, to turn ourselves into gods of the Greek type, he insists. But nevertheless, this is Homo Deus, the title of his book, The Man That Is God, or Our God-Man. Now, when I first read that, I realized that this is very ancient stuff, and it appears very early on in the Bible. The first creature that suggested that humans should become gods was a snake, which perhaps ought to alert us that this isn't completely straightforward. The temptation was, you will be as gods, knowing good and evil. Now, the situation in which that occurred is extremely important, because it is telling us some of the wonderful gifts that human beings have made in the image of God. And one of them is the capacity to choose. They were placed in a garden and they were told to eat of every fruit they could indulge themselves, but there was one that was forbidden. And here we see the basic ingredients for morality. There must be something forbidden, but there must be the capacity to do the forbidden thing. If the tree was surrounded by an electric fence, they couldn't have done anything. They must have had the capacity to do it. And the temptation came, it appealed to their desire to be, in that sense, upgraded. They wanted to rise. And the enemy said, the serpent that turns out to be God's enemy, ultimately the devil, so far as we can see, said, God knows that in the day you eat of it, you shall be as God, knowing good and evil. Now, that has been massively misinterpreted, both in literature and in philosophy, as to be read as if God was against knowledge. Absolute nonsense. There was a lot of knowledge in this garden that God wanted them to have. But the knowledge of good and evil, when they got it, they realized this is not the kind of knowledge you want to have. And it led to a devastation of human beings by sin, as the Bible calls it, rebellion against God, setting yourself free and disobeying God into the world with all the damage that is caused. Now, why is this important? Because the idea of becoming God is an idea that from that point on has figured from time to time in history very prominently in the empires of the ancient Near East, in the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire, and even up to the present day, of course. Ceausescu, for example, in Romania claiming to be a god, and Hoxha in Albania. And now we have explicitly in the name of scientific development that we humans should aspire to be gods. Now, you ask me, is there anything wrong with enhancing ourselves? Well, in that sense, no. I'm looking at you through glasses. Otherwise, you'd be a blur. I'm very grateful for that enhancement, which, of course, with contact lenses wouldn't be so visible. It's one thing to enhance human beings' mark one, so to speak, which we are. But it's a very different thing to begin to alter the specification of human nature. Now, what do I mean by that? One of the books that influenced me many years ago, and still does, is The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. And C.S. Lewis made the point in the 1940s. He talks about man's power over nature. I quote, "Man's power over nature turns out to be a power exercised by some men over other men with nature as its instrument. Man's conquest of nature, if the dreams of some scientific planners are realized, means the rule of a few hundred men over billions upon billions of men. There neither is nor can be any simple increase of power on man's side. Each new power won by man is a power over man as well. Each advance leaves him weaker as well as stronger. In every victory, besides being the general who triumphs, he's also the prisoner who follows the triumphal car." And then these chilling words, "Man's final conquest has proved to be the abolition of man." And Lewis points out that what these scientists of the future, and now we're already arrived, we have the capacity to do this, will be the abolition of man, because what will be produced are not creatures in the image of God. They're artifacts in the image of certain scientists who have arrogated this power unto themselves. Now, for me as a Christian, seeing that, it rings alarm bells all over the place, because it appeals to people who have bought into the great lie that was set going in Genesis chapter 3, that God is somehow against them. He's trying to keep them down, and he doesn't want them to rise to his level. Now, if I examine that, I see how hollow it is. Take the two agenda items that I referred to. One, Harari's hope to conquer death as a purely technical problem. Well, I disagree with him, because human death came into creation as a result of human disobedience. It is all tied up with disobedience to God, and it won't be simply solved by discovering some elixir of life. But then I reflect and I say to Professor Harari, you're too late. You're hoping for the abolition of death in the future, but actually death has already been conquered, human physical death, in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Now, this immediately shows us how utterly relevant the central claim of Christianity is to the whole artificial general intelligence scenario. Because that scenario is, as I said earlier, humans becoming gods. But the message of Christianity is that God has become human, that humans are so utterly unique that God was able to become one. That's the reverse direction. Secondly, that the death that had been brought into the world through human disobedience, Jesus Christ, who himself was sinless, was raised by God from the dead. And the New Testament is wonderful in the metaphors it uses describing this Christ's resurrection as the first fruits of a great harvest, meaning that those who trust Christ as Savior and Lord, repent of the mess they've made of their own lives and those of others maybe, if they trust him, they receive in this life God's life, eternal life, and God will raise them from the dead. So in the end, COVID-19 cannot do anything about that. And there's a wonderful statement in John chapter 11 that I've referred to a great deal during the COVID crisis, where Mary and Martha and Lazarus in this little nuclear family, Lazarus died and Jesus wasn't there. And they sent him a message and he didn't come. And they were very disturbed by that, of course. And Lazarus died. And that raises the deep COVID question. Doesn't God care? But when Jesus arrived, Martha said to him, "Lord, if you'd been here, my brother would not have died." That's fascinating. It shows that Martha believed that he had the power. So the issue was he really willing? And she challenged him on that. Even now, she says, "I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you." Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again," which, by the way, is an incredible comfort for those who have lost relatives, believing relatives, that the relationship is not lost entirely. Your father will rise again, your mother, and so on. This is most encouraging. And Martha, theologically trained as she was, said, "I know he will rise again, the resurrection, the last day." And then she was shaken by this incredible statement. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" And that's the challenge for me and all of us, that Christ is here claiming that he is the one who's going to operate the final resurrection. And the evidence of that is in his own resurrection. So that's Harari's point number one. And this is a much more credible scenario than his. But the second one then is that this idea of upgrading, well, it's contained in the promise of the resurrection of the dead. "This corruptible," says Paul, "must put on incorruption." And he talks in 1 Corinthians 15 about the future resurrection of the dead. This is the big upgrade. You see, Christianity offers us two upgrades. The first one we experience in this life, when we trust Christ, turning away from our rebellion against him and receive his life, that gives us a new power to live. But that's not the end of it. That's just the beginning of it. Because that very same power of God's Spirit that indwells us and we receive when we trust him will raise us from the dead, and the dead will be raised imperishable, and we shall be we shall then be, as Jesus himself said, we shall be forever with him. And just earlier on in this passage in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul says, "Just as we've borne the image of the man of dust, we shall bear the image of the man of heaven." This business of the image of God runs the whole way through. And if we can get our heads round it, it seems to me this agenda is much more credible than the transhumanist agenda, because it does not try to create utopia by bypassing the problem of human sin and rebellion. All efforts at creating utopia, the Russian, the Soviet effort at creating a new man, and many of the eugenics attempts in the Third Reich and so on, they all fail and lead to the murder of millions. Why? Because they bypass the problem of human sin. Now, we've talked a lot about the resurrection of Jesus, but you see, the problem of human sin is dealt with by what preceded the resurrection, which is the cross of Christ. And I firmly believe that on that cross, he died to bear my sin. Now, there's a lot of moral criticism of that. And those of you who are interested in what I think about it, I've written in extenso about it in my book, Gunning for God, to show that the atonement is not an immoral concept at all, but is the answer to the deepest longing of the human heart for forgiveness and peace with God. So what I want to do in my book is to say to people, look, if you listen to people like Professor Max Tegmark of Princeton and others with their scenarios of a superintelligence, I would like to talk to you about the biblical scenario. And of course, as many people watching will know, the book of Revelation talks about the future. Now, that's a topic really for another time. But if you go back to the plain, straightforward, non-symbolic text of Paul writing to the Thessalonians, he tells us that there will come someone who claims to be a Homodeus, but he won't be the true one. And this leader will exercise incredible power, some of which is described in very highly metaphorical language in the book of Revelation, but it seems to be describing a reality, will have unlimited commercial control. Well, we can relate to that immediately. But as I say, I do take the risk of developing some of these ideas in 2084.
Thank you, John. That is so useful. Just got a question that's come in that says, basically, how should we then respond to AI? And I guess as we're aware of our own mortality and our own flaws, should we use it at all? Should we try to change our genes? What's the kind of right approach to that?
Well, there are several questions there. And I think that with any technological revolution brings increased moral problems. We haven't even touched on the problems of loss of jobs when robots replace people. And although that creates new job opportunities, they won't be open to everybody. But we need to beware of trends in thinking. You see, when Paul wrote Thessalonians, he said, look, as he talked about the future, he said, this kind of thing is operating in our society right now. And he was referring to the Homodeus claims of the Caesars. We need to be aware of this kind of stuff and build it into our thinking. But that's not a reason not to be involved in doing AI research ourselves and developing very positive things. I think of the marvelous work of Professor Rosalind Picard in MIT, who's developed facial recognition techniques, which she applies to children with various kinds of autistic problems and uses them to predict serious episodes of fits and so on and can save their lives. This is marvelous stuff. So we need to embrace the technology, but to do it wisely and particularly to think through and, of course, be prepared to call hype what it is, hype, and think through the moral issues. But also, it seems to me this is a hugely interesting talking point. Everybody's interested in it. And for that reason, it gives us something that we can talk about and credibly put a Christian input into. Let's not allow the whole thing to be driven by atheist transhumanist thinkers. Let's get involved and show that Christians have a right to sit at the table. And hopefully we can say something credible and then encourage people, as I would encourage our watchers and listeners here today, to make up their own minds about it.
Thank you, John. Just picking up on that, if we are looking in today and we think, okay, I want to benefit from what you're claiming that Jesus Christ offers, this the resurrection, the true upgrading, how would you suggest I go about that? What would that
Well,
be?
It depends entirely on who you are. But the first thing is to become a little bit biblically literate. In other words, start reading something like the Gospel of John. And in the first level, just read it as you might read any other historical document and ask your questions. And then use available internet information. At St. Helen's Church, there's a great database of talks that are given, like this every Tuesday and Thursday for many years back, on many topics. And you can use those to inform yourself. I often say to people, look, you can't decide about Christianity until you know what it says. Well, give it a chance. Listen to what it has to say before you decide to reject it. And I think that's the way to go about things. And another way is to, of course, ask for your friends who are Christians what it means to them and push them hard, because this is a huge issue. It has to do with the meaning of life. It has to do with whether there's a God or not. It has to do with ultimate destiny. These are the biggest questions we can ever ask. So we need to take our time and do our investigating and then make our decision on the basis of what we know.
Thanks, John. It's so fantastic having you with us today. Thank you.